This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we examine the state of the transatlantic relationship as tensions mount between European allies and U.S. President Donald Trump. We analyze the potential impact of Brexit on the integrity of the European Union, and we ponder the future of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which celebrates its 70th birthday this year. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On January 15th, the British Parliament rejected Prime Minister Theresa May's proposed agreement for the country to leave the European Union by a wide margin, a resounding defeat underscoring the deep political discord in the UK on how and whether to leave the bloc. However, May subsequently survived a no-confidence vote, which affords her another chance to pull together some sort of agreement or request a delay to avert a chaotic no-deal Brexit on March 29. With us to discuss the ramifications of Brexit, the transatlantic relationship writ large, and the future of NATO, especially given President Trump's skepticism of the stalwart alliance, are two distinguished analysts. Jeffrey Rathke is the president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at Johns Hopkins University here in Washington. Previously, Jeffrey served as senior fellow and deputy director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and he's been at these microphones before. He's also served in numerous senior posts at the U.S. Department of State. And Thomas Wright, he's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institution. That's a policy group based in Washington. And this is Thomas's debut on the program. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carol. Great to be back.
Well, Jeffrey, let me begin with you. Let's talk about Brexit first. Why do you think Parliament overwhelmingly rejected Theresa May's deal, hammered out so painstakingly with the EU?
Well, part of the problem, I think, is an inability in the British political leadership to decide exactly what they want out of Brexit. On the one hand, and I think that's why you see this vote going against Theresa May, it wasn't that their objections were the same, but you have a very strong pro-EU bloc within the Parliament. And so, of course, they are unhappy with the terms Theresa May negotiated because they will perhaps diminish the British economic interaction with the European Union and have negative consequences. And on the other side, you've got the stalwart Brexiteers who feel that May's agreement didn't go far enough in breaking ties with the European Union, in particular the question of the so-called backstop, which deals with the relationship between Ireland and Northern Ireland, that border, as well as the future of Britain. Is it in the customs union? Can it negotiate its own free trade agreements elsewhere? So you had this sort of bifurcated opposition, which when you add it up is overwhelming, but it doesn't actually point in a particular direction as far as resolving the impasse.
Turning to you, Tom Wright, this looks like a very difficult needle to thread. How do you interpret why Parliament overwhelmingly rejected May's deal? What else do you have to add or subtract to what Jeffrey just said?
Yes, I agree with Jeffrey that there was overwhelming opposition from two different sources. The actual opposition, the Labour Party, the SNP, the Liberal Democrats, generally opposed it because they felt it was too harsh. They generally want a softer Brexit, which would be more like the deal that Norway has or some version of that. But of course, Theresa May has a majority in Parliament with the support of the DUP, so she shouldn't need their votes. She has a small majority of 325. It gives her a majority of about 10 or so. And the reason she lost those votes was because of the Irish backstop provision. That's their main objection. And the meaning of that provision is that essentially the UK as a whole will have to remain in the customs union and have an alignment of their regulations with the European Union indefinitely until they negotiate a trade agreement that would have the same effect in keeping the border open between Ireland and Northern Ireland. And what they believed was that that was a permanent straitjacket that would mean that exiting the EU would be a name only and they wouldn't actually have any control over trade deals or even over their own regulations. And so they rebelled on that. Theresa May has now gone back and said she's going to try to get some concessions on the backstop, but it's very unlikely because that was the core of the agreement. You can get concessions on things that are tangential or don't matter that much, but it's very hard to get a compromise on the actual core substance of the deal. And we're seeing them try that now, but they're up against the clock. They have till March 29th, and they automatically fall out of the European Union without a deal. This is something where the party system is basically broken down, and so no one really knows how it will turn out at this point.
Well, back to you, Jeffrey Rathke, because you opened up with a very important statement, which is, it looks like the UK doesn't really know what it wants. It knows what it doesn't want. So where do we go from here? What are the options to avert a chaotic no deal, which would mean a hard exit? I'm sure all parties would like to avoid that.
I'm not sure all parties want to avoid that. There is a hard core of conservatives who are quite comfortable with and actually desire a hard Brexit. And they are of the view that that will be sort of the abrupt stroke that frees Britain from the constraints that the European Union would otherwise be putting on them. I think it's remarkably short-sighted, personally, but there are some who desire it. I think one possibility is Theresa May tries to get some kind of concessions from Brussels. And I agree totally with Tom. The European Union is not in a mood to renegotiate. They've been sending that signal consistently. People in the United Kingdom have failed to take it seriously, I think, but I don't think there's any real scope to make meaningful changes to the deal that Theresa May had already negotiated with the European Union. The other possibility is simply Britain crashes out of the European Union on March 29th. There might be some idea of prolonging that, but maybe that's really tied up more with the third possibility. You know, there has been a push by a number of political leaders, including former Prime Minister John Major, among others, who have said, you know, there should be another vote, that the result of the negotiations should be put to a popular referendum, just like we had back in 2016. That's also extremely complicated. What would the question be in the referendum? In that context, though, if there were a new vote, then you might have some willingness on the European side to prolong the deadline of March 29th a bit longer, but not much longer, because you have also the matter of European Parliament elections that are happening in May. And right now, those are supposed to go ahead without British participation. But if you get into a scenario where you could have Britain remaining or at least staying in longer, then you've got another set of issues that European leaders really don't want to have to grapple with. So they are not willing to entertain an indefinite prolongation. And I think there are many people in the UK who haven't really taken that seriously, especially the pro-Brexit forces. I think they've always had this very inwardly focused idea that all that matters is what they decide, and then eventually they can get the Europeans to accept it, which has proven to be fatally flawed.
Turning back to you, Tom Wright, what is the likelihood, in your view, of a second referendum, and what would be the question? Because some analysts say, and polls show, that perhaps if they had a do-over, the British may not have voted to leave. They probably didn't understand the ramifications, and the vote was close anyway.
I think one thing that's very clear from the last week in terms of the Prime Minister's statements after losing the vote is that she is absolutely determined to avoid a no Brexit, that she believes that her biggest failing would be if Britain did not actually leave the EU. And previous to the vote, I thought that a second referendum was quite likely because I thought she would essentially come to that as the final option to say, I've tried to get it through, I can't, we're going to have a referendum unless you vote for my deal, to try to put pressure on her own side. If they called her bluff, then she would say, I'm going for another vote and I'm going to campaign to leave on my deal. That's still possible. They may default to that, but she's made it very clear in her statement 3 days after losing the vote that she did not want another referendum under any circumstances. If they did have it, the question is difficult because there are three options and it's very hard to have a referendum between three options, but they could do it in a number of ways. They could have a preferential system where you rank them 1, 2, 3, and then you count the second preferences. She believes she would win that vote because her option is everyone's second choice. You know, if you want to leave, you would prefer her deal to remaining and vice versa. But these are all very complex and they all have flaws. I would just add one other outcome, which I think at the moment is probably to me the most likely outcome, which is a softer Brexit. She has two places she can get votes from. She can get votes from her own hardliners or she can get votes from the opposition. And she may conclude ultimately that she will stand a better chance of getting votes from Labour. And so she could have a Norway-style deal where they stay in the customs union, a single market indefinitely, but leave on other fronts. But there's a variety of different type of what they call in the UK shenanigans that could occur the closer we get to the deadline.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Jeffrey Rathke. He's president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Thomas Wright, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Center on the United States and Europe and a senior fellow in the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institution. And we're discussing strains in the transatlantic relationship and the ramifications of Brexit. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Encounter fan, Bin Cool from Vinh, Vietnam. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Jeffrey Rathke. Just one quick follow-up on Brexit and implications for the EU. We're seeing other trends in Europe, too. We're seeing the so-called yellow vest, the gilets jaunes in France, protests against the institutions, against globalization writ large, the impact that, at least of globalization, which cannot really be put back in the bottle, but I guess mitigating proposals or policies could be implemented. What do you make of these trends, Brexit, the gilets jaunes, and other trends toward populism in the continent and the impact on the EU itself? Will they perhaps persuade Brussels to make some changes, and will that make a difference?
I think there are a couple of different trends, and they don't all point in the same direction. Because on the one hand, Brexit has been sobering for the rest of Europe. On the one hand, it has been at least an annoyance for most European governments. There are some who have offered a little bit of mild rhetorical support to Prime Minister May and to Britain. And that certainly, there are many that want to avoid the hardest Brexit option. But in general, the other 27 governments have stuck together. They defined a negotiating position, and they've stuck to it. So on the one hand, there's been this consolidation in a practical way of pro-European sentiment. And if you look at public opinion, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, that is the newer member states of the European Union, public opinion is quite positive about the European Union, which really cuts against this image that you get when you look at the yellow vest protests of public discontent boiling out into, at times, even violence on the streets. So I think you have different trends, and they aren't all this distrust in institutions and a desire to tear Europe apart.
Turning back to you, Tom Wright, for your take on the implications of Brexit, the deep concerns that Brexit has exposed vis-a-vis the EU, perhaps frustration with what is perceived as a stodgy Brussels bureaucracy, and of course, the impact of globalization, which has really affected many segments of society. There's a lot of good, but there's a lot of downsides to globalization. So this is sort of a way to act out against it. Brexit, yellow vests, trying to, you know, protest.
Yeah. I think Brexit is a symptom of a larger development, which is prior to the financial crisis, there was really a broad consensus in European politics on sort of the way forward. You had the centre-left and centre-right disagreeing about spending and tax, but basically agreeing on the euro, on the European Union, on further integration with twists and turns, but broadly in that direction. And the debate was quite narrow. And since then, we've seen really an expanding of the discourse in a political society, that range expanded considerably. And it's including now ideas that simply didn't exist prior to 08 or 09. Nobody was arguing for Brexit prior to the financial crisis, bar maybe one or two MPs. UKIP hadn't existed, you know, it wasn't on the agenda. The five-star movement in Italy was not a thing. Neither was Syriza in Greece. There weren't the yellow vests or any of these other sort of ideas. And so what's sort of been happening is, after a little bit of a time lag to develop these ideas, that they're now all bubbling to the fore. And we have really an explosion in debate on all sorts of radical notions that were unthinkable previously. And they're by and large incompatible with each other, right? Or they're certainly incompatible with European integration. And I think that makes it exciting, but it also makes it quite depressing, because it's resulting in this great volatility. A lot of these ideas are extremely wrong-headed, in my opinion, or they're certainly not thought through in terms of where they will lead. And so you have increased volatility in Europe, and I think the makings of a crisis down the road.
Back to you, Jeffrey Rathke. What about the relationship between the United States and Europe, particularly under President Trump? He has consistently criticized many of our allies in Europe, while he reserves either praise or no criticism for Vladimir Putin's Russia, which of course would like to see the breakup of the EU, even NATO. So let's take a look at EU-US relations very briefly. And in another blow to that relationship, we saw recently the departure of the Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasian Affairs decide to leave his post. How significant is that development, and how do you see EU-US relations under Mr. Trump?
Well, I think I might separate those two. First, I would start where you started, which is the way the president looks at Europe and the U.S. relationship with Europe. And it is quite skeptical and at times even downright hostile, I would say. If we just look at the U.K. and Brexit, for example, Donald Trump has spoken out in favor of Brexit. He did so right after the referendum, and that's been a consistent theme of his. And he's done so in a way that actually has weakened Theresa May internally, because Theresa May herself was not in favor of Brexit when the referendum happened, but then she became prime minister and had to negotiate this deal. The president has constantly criticized the outcome of that deal. He said he could have gotten a better deal and basically has undermined her. And I think this has emboldened a number of the real hard Brexiteers. I don't think it's been the only thing that's encouraged them, but it's certainly been a factor. But at the same time, the United States has done nothing really to support the United Kingdom in more direct terms. For example, negotiating a free trade agreement. The United States is not going to be helpful to Britain if the Trump administration ever gets around to negotiating a trade agreement with the UK. It would be delusional to expect otherwise if you look at the way the Trump administration is approaching its other deals. They're quite tough, and they're not in the habit of giving things away. So I think that's, on the one hand, the relationship to the European Union. And I think that it all takes place in the context of a broader questioning by the United States leadership of 70 years of accepted wisdom in how we approach the world. That is, the United States makes investments in international order and in our alliances because they create an environment that is favorable not only to our allies, but first and foremost to the United States. You know, we do these things in our interest, not out of charity. And so that is what is fundamentally at question. And it's why the president takes aim at NATO. And it's why you see this backlash in the Congress. Just in the last week, you've had the House pass a bill with an overwhelming veto-proof majority that would basically say no federal government money can be spent to take the United States out of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. There's a similar move afoot in the Senate, although the language of that bill is different. And so I think what you're going to see is a continued emphasis by Congress on a bipartisan basis to limit the president's ability to pull the United States out of NATO.
Well, turning back to you, Tom Wright, to comment on both the Transatlantic Alliance and, of course, NATO, because we've seen and heard statements by President Trump saying that he would like to withdraw from NATO, which, of course, caused enormous alarm in Europe and here in the United States, so much so that, as Jeffrey said, Congress recently passed legislation that seeks to bar President Trump from withdrawing from NATO amid his concerns over our commitment to the pact. And this all fits in with his skepticism about Europe and, once again, the signs that he is more aligned with Russia than with our allies. And so this is a deep concern, and I assume it continues to undermine the EU as well as NATO. It must be of concern. What are you hearing?
I think NATO is more vulnerable this year than at any point since the beginning of the Trump administration. If you look at what the president said early on as a candidate and then as president-elect and then as president, he was skeptical of NATO. He called it obsolete. He didn't endorse Article 5 when it was in his speech. He took it out at his speech at Brussels in 2017 at NATO headquarters. But in that early phase, he kept having to sort of pull back because his team was very mainstream and sort of dedicated to the alliance. Mattis in particular, McMaster and others were all committed to NATO. And the story of last year, starting in March 2018, moving on to December 21st, is he pushed out or replaced all of the mainstream members of the cabinet who were sort of part of this axis of adults that was sort of trying to constrain him, and he replaced them with people who were almost entirely loyalist. And if they weren't loyalist, they were sort of inexperienced and relatively weak and unable to stand up to him. And so we entered 2019 in the position where he's sort of unbound. He's increasingly just giving orders and demanding things. He's not holding interagency meetings. We saw that in Syria. We see it in other things. And Assistant Secretary of State Mitchell's resignation sort of plays into that, because there are four people at that sort of level in the administration who work on NATO. Three of them have left, two officials in the Pentagon and now Mitchell. And there's only one, my old colleague Fiona Hill, and the NSC remaining. And so I think there's really very little support for NATO left in the administration at this point. So it's quite vulnerable.
Vulnerable, but now we have this legislation, so that should constrain Mr. Trump. Jeffrey, and as we close, some final thoughts from you with regard to the Transatlantic Alliance. As you said, the U.S. role in the world, notwithstanding congressional support for NATO and many of the cabinet members under Mr. Trump, they have all left. So how do you see the relationship? And I assume trust has eroded. Can the damage perhaps in the relationship be repaired? Or do they see Mr. Trump as perhaps a passing phenomenon or an anomaly because he's not really in the mainstream? How do you see this going forward?
You know, there are so many paradoxes in this. On the one hand, I agree with everything Tom has said about NATO. The U.S. commitment to NATO is in question. At the same time, under Trump's administration, the United States has spent a lot more money in Europe in the so-called European Deterrence Initiative. So you have a rising presence of U.S. military forces in Europe for the first time since really the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. And you have this congressional support, and you have had a more or less traditional foreign policy kind of happening at the working level. So these bills, if they were to pass the House and to become law, they would certainly be a constraint on the president's ability to formally withdraw. But I think the other important thing to remember is that the purpose of NATO is deterrence, and in particular, it's deterring Russia. So deterrence is always in the mind of the person who is being deterred. What is written on paper matters, but what really matters is whether the Russian leadership believes that the American president will react in a way that Russia doesn't like if Russia were to infringe on NATO's territorial integrity or its interests. And so even if the United States remains a member of NATO, if the president signals that he's not serious about defending a NATO ally that is attacked or put under pressure, then the game's half over. And so, you know, I think the steps such as Congress is taking are quite significant because they place a political constraint on the president. But it's hard to force the president to do concrete things that he doesn't want to do. The president has a lot of prerogatives. And so I think, as Tom said, this is a very crucial time, and it's a time when Congress, as well as other parts of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, need to be doing everything they can to preserve the orders that we have established for good reason and that we have sustained for good reason to prevent chaos and to promote American security.
Prevent chaos, promote American security, and to thwart and combat the nefarious actions of actors like Russia, Thomas Wright. Final last word to you. What are you hearing from our colleagues in Europe, in NATO? How do they see what's going on? These statements by Mr. Trump, which are hostile vis-a-vis NATO. Is there a way to sort of reverse this lack of trust?
They are worried, I think, for sure. One of the lessons they took from the last 2 years is that things get most volatile when the president is directly involved. And they can have a decent working relationship with members of the administration. And so they're trying to avoid him as much as possible. That's why the 70th anniversary summit, which you mentioned earlier, is taking place not at the leaders level, but at the foreign ministers level. So Pompeo is going to host it. So I think that's one example of the sort of workarounds. But it is quite sort of fragile. For Trump, it's a little bit like Bob Mueller. He'd like to fire Mueller, but he feels like he might get into trouble. I think he'd like to pull out of NATO, but he knows he's going to get into trouble.
On that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Jeffrey Rathke. He's president of the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Tom Wright, director of the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guests. Our engineer was Cornelius Tenner. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.